Welcome to Spiritual Cartel Step Meeting. This week we'll be covering Step 8 and 9. And tonight I'm pleased to introduce Ian S, who's kindly agreed to come and share for us. Ian, over to you. The floor's yours.
Thank you, Pauline, and thanks to all of you for having me here. My name is Ian S, and I'm a recovered alcoholic and addict. And I'm very grateful to be here to talk with you about two really important, super high octane steps in our common program of recovery, steps 8 and 9. Now, I'm going to start by the beginning by saying that when I talk about these steps, what I'm going to talk about is what the book Alcoholics Anonymous, our beloved big book, says about them. There's plenty of fellowship folklore, plenty of meeting wisdom, plenty of things sponsors have said over the years about these topics. And I'm not here to say that any of that is correct or incorrect. What I'm here to talk about is our common program of recovery. What does the book Alcoholics Anonymous say about how to take these steps? This is how I did it, and I was able to recover from a truly hopeless condition. And so I think if we do that, we can be quite assured of recovery. If we do it some other way, I don't really have an opinion about that, okay? I say this disclaimer at the beginning because sometimes when I talk at meetings, I hear a lot of pushback because the book Alcoholics Anonymous in its contents is not always that popular in AA and CA meetings, surprisingly enough, but I like it, and I'm going to talk about it. So steps 8 and 9. Steps 8 and 9 are addressed in chapter Into Action, right? And let me just situate a little bit where we are when we take these steps. So at this point in our recovery, we've completed our moral inventory, right? We've done our dreaded fourth step. We've taken a couple of days to take thorough stock of our deficiencies, our problems, our character defects, whatever. And we've shared them with someone else. We've taken the fifth step in our program of recovery, and we've fully acquainted somebody else with our shortcomings, right? Now, when we start steps 8 and 9, those are events that should have taken place about an hour ago. Because one of the things that this chapter talks about is that after we're through with sharing what we've written in our moral inventory in step 5, we should take about an hour to reflect on our work so far. We should immediately take steps 6 and 7, which are described on page 76 of the book. We won't go into those because we're going to talk about other stuff, but they can be done quite rapidly. And then immediately it says, now, it says on page 76, we need more action. When do we take steps 8 and 9? Now, we take them now. We take them immediately, because without which we will find that faith without works is dead. This book does not use those words lightly. That's a quotation from the book of James. And it really has been true in my experience that putting off steps 8 and 9, and God, they are easy steps to want to put off, aren't they? Because they're so scary. And I totally understand that. We're going to talk about some ways maybe they could be a little less scary, but it's so easy to put them off. But if we do, we are not going to experience the promises of recovery. And for alcoholics and addicts like me, and maybe like you, to experience relapse is to court and eventually experience death or insanity or, you know, mental institutions, jails, who knows what it'll be. Maybe just misery. That doesn't sound so good either, right? So if we're serious about getting better, we have to do these things, and we have to, I think, start right away. But how do we do it, right? How do we actually take steps 8 and 9? It's not too complicated, right? Because the first thing that we'll realize is that the reason the book treats them together, it says, let's take a look at steps 8 and 9, is because in step 8, we have this list, right? But it says we already have a list of all persons we've harmed and to whom we're willing to make amends. Like, by the time we get here, we already have a list. Where did we get this list? When did we write this list? We made it when we took inventory. Ah, yes, of course, because as we were reflecting on all the people that we were angry at and all of the things that we were afraid of, like I used to be really afraid about the fact that I owed like huge amounts of money to people I had no way to pay, right? And as we reflect on certainly the harms that we've caused in our sexual relationships, in our intimate relationships, as we reflect on the harms that we caused just, you know, because of our sex drive and all that stuff that we took inventory of, we'll have a big long list of people that we've harmed. And when we were doing inventory, we started to become willing to make amends to those people. So we already have our list, right? So don't just throw the paper away when you're done with your fifth step. Hold on to it at least for long enough to do this. And then it says, now what we're going to do is go out to our fellows and repair the damage done in the past. Put differently, we attempt to sweep away the debris which has accumulated out of our former way of life, our former effort to live on self-will and run the show ourselves. And if we're scared about this, what do? Say we're working on it? No. Go to a meeting and tell everybody how, you know, we're really excited about 8 and 9. We're going to get started any day now? No. Call our sponsor and complain about something else? No. If we haven't the will to do this, we ask, who? God, until it comes, right? If you're scared about doing this stuff, and I was very scared about many of the people I needed to approach and many of the things that I needed to do. I could not do all of them immediately because I was too scared. But until you are not too scared, you have one task. Ask God for the willingness to do this until it comes. You have no other business to attend to right now. What could possibly be more important than this? Put this off and you will court death. So ask until it comes. Okay, fair enough. But again, what do we actually do? And here the book is so helpful because it is so specific about a variety of specific situations, which kind of cover, you know, not everything, but really close to everything, right? Almost all of the amends and all of the cleanup that needs to happen tend to fall within some really common categories, right? Now, there are an infinite number of ways that we can cause harm that we need to clean up, but there are some really common categories that these things fall into. And there's a great deal of specific advice as to each of these categories. So I hope if you're sitting here and thinking, all right, yeah, I've got my list, but I'm not really sure what to do with it. Maybe now we can find out. And like, maybe by the end of the day, you could get started. Let's see if we can do that. So the first specific group of people that the chapter talks about and how to deal with is people that we have hated, right? And boy, there are those people, aren't they? It talks about this starting on page 77. It says the question of how to approach the man or the woman that we've hated will arise. And in particular, it might be that this person has done us more harm than we've done them. Right? That's a fact about the world. I've caused people harm and who have caused me much more harm. What do I do about that? Right? Because, maybe I have a better attitude, but I'm still not too keen about admitting my faults to that person. The book gives some really specific advice on this, which is, look, it is harder to go to an enemy than to a friend. But we find it says, much more beneficial to us. The spiritual power that is unlocked by going to a person who really, you know, has harmed you a great deal and going there and cleaning up your side of the street is immense and very rewarding. So if it's possible, the book is encouraging us to say, look, this is really a great place to begin. Because it's easy to go to a friend and say, gee, I'm sorry, when we know we're going to experience forgiveness. It's harder to go to an enemy. Perhaps it's a good place to start for that reason. Now, when we're doing that, under no condition ever do we criticize this person. Under no condition ever do we argue with this person, right? Instead, what we are there to do is one of the famous lines from this book, sweep off our side of the street. That's so famous, it's in a Taylor Swift song. Realizing that nothing worthwhile can be accomplished until we do so, right? That's from page 77 to 78. We never discuss the faults of the other person, right? We stick to our own. Always. Because if you don't do that, guess what? You're just going to cause more harm and you're going to have to make amends for that. More paperwork, more stuff to discuss. We don't want to be doing that. We want a new way of life, right? Of course we do. So we stick to our own best we can. And it doesn't give us a lot of specific scripts about what to say, right? You can ask God for guidance on that. But if our manner is calm and frank and open, and if we're clear, like if we admit the things that we've done, sometimes we get a nice surprise. Actually, a lot of times we get a nice surprise. One of the things that the book says is like in 9 times out of 10, something unexpected will happen. It's not so bad, right? Sometimes feuds will melt away. Sometimes these people will even, you know, wish us well, but sometimes they don't. Okay. Sometimes we don't get a warm reaction, but that's fine. If this person throws you out of their house or doesn't answer a text message or, you know, wants to just lay into you, it's all fine. We have no control over how people respond to this. We have control over what we're there to do. And if we're there to make the demonstration, do our part, and, you know, do whatever's necessary to clean up the harm that we've done, we're going to be gratified with the results spiritually, no matter what, right? And once it's done, it's done. So you can only get a bad reaction to this from somebody once, right? So do your best, go to them, and there you go. That's the advice it gives to the person we've hated, okay? Pretty straightforward. and pretty clear. The most important thing to take away from there is you, even if it is eating you up inside, even if this person has grievously wronged you and you've really only hurt them a little bit, we're not going to discuss that. Right. Because and let me tell you something. One thing you should not hope for is to ever like get amends from any of the people who brought it. Life doesn't work that way, folks. You are there to get the results you're going to get from admitting your own faults. Right. That's how this works. And if you do that, you will get something much better than an apology from somebody else. You will get permanent recovery from addiction, which is killing you. Right. A little bit better when you think about it. So that's what you do with that. That tends to cover a huge number of the people on our list. People we're mad at. Take a while to build up the nerve to do it, but very beneficial. Okay. Next specific situation that the chapter discusses is another huge one that I actually don't hear discussed that much, even though it's very important and very powerful, is money. Most alcoholics, it says, and most addicts owe money. And like I already alluded to, when I was first, you know, working through this process, I was like, yeah, tell me about it, right? I must have reread that sentence for comfort hundreds of times because I owed huge amounts of money and I had absolutely none to pay anybody. Sometimes I found myself wondering, why did all these people loan me all this money in the first place, right? How did I get myself this far into debt? Why did they ever think I was going to be able to pay this back? Who knows? But look, here's something really important that I discovered in that process. Being afraid of my creditors, of whom there were many, was very spiritually dangerous. It ate at me all the time until I got this handled. I would sit at my desk, the desk I'm sitting at right now, and this was months after I recovered, and I would just sit there in fear and just weep silently, not knowing what I'm gonna do, right? Because I thought, hey, once I stop drinking and getting high all the time, my money worries are over because, you know, I'm gonna save so much money that I'm not spending anymore. Well, that's true, right? It was better. It improved my financial position and that it wasn't getting any worse. But man, I had dug myself a hole, a deep hole, right? I'm not talking, you know, I didn't know my mama, $20. I'm talking real money and I did not have it. So I would be terrified, right? And in that scared state, we already know from working on our fear inventory, we know that fear is a major, major enemy of spiritual fitness. And that's why the book says that, look, we do not dodge our creditors. We must lose our fear of creditors no matter how far we have to go, because we are liable to drink, use if we are afraid to face them. Boy, that's true. That's really true. I have lost people who were making great progress in their recovery because they just felt, I'm so far in over my head, I don't know what I'm ever going to do. And they sought the release that they knew would come very quickly from drugs and alcohol. So what do we do? Well, we have to just confront them. We have to, as my sponsor said, take the call, pay the bill. And if we can't, we need to tell them that, right? If we're in a position like I was in, where it's like, look, I could give you every dime I have, and it wouldn't even be like a little bit of what I owed you. And also there's all these other people, then we've got to arrange the best deal that we can, right? Sometimes that might require the assistance of a professional, right? You might have to organize your whole, you might have to reorganize your whole life in like bankruptcy. You might have to talk to a credit counselor. You might have to talk to somebody. There's professionals in this world who can help you with this stuff. But one way or another, right, we have to arrange the best deal that we can, let them know we're sorry. And look, our drinking or our using has made us slow to pay. Certainly was for me. But once we've gotten right with all of them and we've said, look, you know, it's going to take me 5 years to pay you back, right? But I'm going to get it paid and this is the best deal I can arrange. Once we've gotten that arranged with everybody, so we don't have to be afraid of the phone ringing anymore. And we don't have to be afraid, of what comes in the mail anymore. The spiritual relief that I experienced from getting this part of my life in order was immense, just absolutely immense. And so, you know, I think there's a reason that we need to pay good attention to this, which is we've got to get on terms we can live with and we're not afraid of our creditors with all the people to whom we owe money, right? And that includes everybody, folks. That includes everybody from the tax authorities to, you know, any drug dealers we've ripped off and everybody in between, right? If we owe money, we got to figure out some way to make everybody whole, right? It might take a long time, but we can do it, right? Because one thing I've also heard is, you know, that let's say it's going to take you 30 years to pay somebody back. You might think, wow, 30 years, that's a long time. Well, it's going to pass one way or the other, right? You want it to pass, you know, clean and sober, or you want to make the situation worse, because one way or another, 30 years are going to roll off the clock. And I'd like for them to roll off in a recovered state. All right. So that's group two, right? Then we got kind of a third situation, which I kind of think of as like crimes and other really serious wrongdoing, right? So perhaps we've committed, for example, a criminal offense, which might land us in jail, or maybe we've done a petty offense like padding our expense account, or maybe we've divorced and we haven't kept up alimony or child support, things like that. There's all sorts of things like this, but in general, the category is like stuff we've done that's wrong that might have really serious consequences if it were found out. Right. And the book gives two really very, very valuable pieces of counsel on this that really have to be taken together. Right. The first thing is, remember, we have decided to go to any lengths to find a spiritual experience. That's from page 79. Right. And we ask that God give us the strength and the direction to do the right thing, no matter what the consequences to us might be. Right. When it just comes to the consequences to us, right, we have to be hard on ourselves, but good to other people. So if it comes to our position, our reputation, time for us in jail, you know, we have to be willing to do that if it's necessary. But in the very next paragraph, the book says, usually other people are involved, right? And we're not to be the hasty and foolish martyr who would sacrifice others to save themselves. I'll give you a good example. I have a 5-year-old son. He depends, and his mother depends on me to, for example, I don't know if you guys have noticed, but 5-year-olds are notoriously lazy. He doesn't even have a job, right? So he needs his dad to be supporting him financially, or otherwise he will find it very difficult to eat as much as he wants. So whatever I do that might affect my position, my job, you know, if I go to jail, things like that, it's not that I shouldn't be willing to do it, but I have to take his interests into account too. Now, how am I going to possibly balance those two difficult things? I've got to be willing to accept personal consequences, but I don't want to be inflicting harm on other people, right? Because I've inflicted enough harm on people. This is about cleaning up the past, not creating more harm just so that, oh, I can get better. So what the book says on page 80 is, look, before we take drastic action that might implicate somebody else, have you ever heard of asking, right? Securing their consent. My sponsor tells a story about a guy who was like, you know, horribly behind on like his mortgage payment and his taxes and all this stuff. And he went to Revenue Canada and said, you know, all right, you got me. And they said, thanks for turning yourself in. And they took his house. And his wife said, you know, maybe you could have put the house in my name and talked to me since I've been the one who's been paying the mortgage all these years. You could have put the house in my name before you did this noble thing, because now all of us are out on the street. Point being, before we take drastic action, let's talk about it with the other people it would implicate, right? We can also consult with people we trust, recovered fellows, a sponsor, a professional. This is where the kinds of professionals I was talking about earlier can be a lot of help. Talk with it. You know, if you're enlarged to the IRS, why don't you talk with a tax attorney about it, or an accountant, right? Et cetera, et cetera. Talk, use these professional services if it's possible. And then most important, we take all of this and ask God to help us see what the right thing to do is, right? And he will show us if we really want to know. We take all this information and we pray for discernment. And before, and you know, the more drastic the step is, I think that the more patient we should be in our prayer for discernment. This does not mean sit on your laurels. This does not mean that we should be farting around and not doing this stuff. But it does mean that we need to be willing to take God's direction on this stuff as best it comes. And we need to take that very seriously. And if we've obtained permission, consulted with other people as necessary, asked God to help, and we can really tell, our conscience is really telling us that some drastic step is indicated, the answer is clear. We must not shrink. You got to do it, right? Because the alternative, whatever the consequences will be, for me, the alternative felt worse, much worse, because I could not live that like that anymore. So that's what we do with what you might call the really serious wrongdoing, right? And that can apply to a lot of things, but it's a wonderful general framework. There's also a long discussion of the very long discussion of the topic of infidelity, right? This is from pages 80 all the way through much of 82, right? The chances that are, it says that we have domestic troubles, right? And what it's really talking about is many of us are not great people to date or be married to or to be intimate partners with of any kind when we are not recovered. I wasn't, and I don't think most people are, right? So the chances are that we have domestic troubles, and the way that can look a lot of times is infidelity and breaking promises and things like that, right? And what the counsel and the book goes into a lot of, you know, very specific advice on this that I'm not going to, you know, detail in enormous length is, but what the basic idea here is, remember, we are there to not cause more harm to other people, right? So for example, if we are sure that our partner does not know what we have done, should we tell them? The book gives no general rule. It says not always. Sometimes yes, sometimes no. And what's going to guide us in how much to tell a person? God, of course, right? And if it's the utmost frankness is demanded, then we must not shrink from that, just like we have before. But we also shouldn't hurt somebody else just so that we can feel good about, ooh, I've come clean, right? That's self-centered. And once again, the only way out of that self-centeredness is asking for strength and direction from the one who has all the power, which is God. And at this point, our relationship with the one who has all the power should be getting, it's getting better, right? We're starting to make contact. We're starting to get some direction there. There's a lot of good advice about this, right? And no, it says no outsider can appraise such an intimate situation. This is one of the many times when this book advises against all of us managing the sex conduct of each other, right? I hear all the time in the fellowship and many fellowships, all sorts of advice about how and when people should be conducting their relationships, what they should do. I don't like to do that because I'm an outsider from those situations and I don't think it's my business to run other people's intimate affairs, right? Instead, the book gives the advice of, hey, why don't you pray about it with the other person's happiness utmost in mind, right? Try asking God, look, I want to be a better partner, husband, wife, boyfriend, girlfriend, whatever, to this person who I love, who perhaps has stuck with me through some really awful stuff. Show me what's good for them, right? Show me what I should do to help this person, right? And the answer is, if you ask in that spirit, I really think will come, right? And it says, keep it always in sight that we're dealing with some terrible human emotions, jealousy, things like that. But ask God for strength and direction, and you'll get that. I think the reason that the book talks about this at such length is because it's a very practical book, right? And I think that in the experience of the people who wrote it, this was a kind of trouble that had come up quite a bit. And so let's take advantage of their experience and use it, right? And even if we have no such complication, that is, if we don't have any kind of infidelity or something to deal with, those kinds of domestic troubles, there's still plenty we should do, either at home, right? Or if we're single, for the people who are close to us in our lives in other ways, right? We've all got people, well, not all of us, but many of us are still lucky enough to have some people who are close to us who have suffered quite a bit because of the consequences of our behavior. But we're a long way from all of those people, from making good to the wife or the husband or the parents, for example, the book mentions, whom for years we have so shockingly treated. And what the book says about this is, there is a long period of reconstruction that lies ahead. And in my experience, the closer the relationship, the longer the period of reconstruction is going to have to be. And we have to take the lead on that, right? We cannot expect other people to just magically forget about the things that have happened to them just because we're trying to live on a different basis now. No, we have to take the lead in reconstructing, right? Repairing the damage that we have done. And we have to be patient, patient. We mistreated other people in many cases for years, for decades sometimes. It is not going to be 2 weeks and all is forgiven. It is not going to be a year or 2 years and all is forgiven in many cases, right? There is a long period of reconstruction ahead. That is why what I like to think about the process of making amends in 8 and 9 as is a period that starts an hour after we're done with taking step 5 and continues for years into the future and really is almost kind of an indefinite task, because living on this new basis and reconstructing a new life and building up a new life is really a task that'll be with us forever. So most importantly, we got to remember, a remorseful mumbling that we're sorry. Love that phrase. What a great writer these guys were. A remorseful mumbling that we're sorry will not fill the bill at all, right? We're going to sit down with our family or whomever else, frankly analyze the past. We're not going to criticize them. And we're going to clean house. And every morning we're going to ask in meditation that our Creator show us the way of patience, tolerance, kindliness, and love. And then here comes one of the other famous sentences in this book. The spiritual life is not a theory. We have to live it day in, day out. some of these spiritual ideas about kindness to others and self-sacrifice and putting the needs of other people first and renouncing a life of selfishness, they sound so good when we're in meetings or when we're talking to our sponsees about them or when we're talking about them ourselves to our own sponsors. And then we've got to actually live day to day with other people who we are tempted to become in collision with, people who do little things that annoy us or people who do things that we wish they would just do better and blah, blah, blah. So day to day, what this is going to look like is, you know, if you, you know, maybe you see something in your home or domestic situation or whatever that annoys you. And maybe instead of just saying the first thing that comes to your mind about it and starting some old argument about who's going to do the dishes, maybe you stop. And on that little thing, that tiny thing, this little dish that's in the sink that you wish weren't there, you're going to live the spiritual life instead of theorizing about it. That is a lot less exciting, right? That's a lot less exciting, but we have to do it, right? We have to do it. The book says if we do that for long enough, they will change in time because, this is probably my favorite sentence in this entire section of the book, our behavior will convince them more than our words. That was especially true in my case, right? I'm a lawyer. I talk and I often talk in complete bullshit for a living. And everybody in my life had heard me plenty talk about my remorse. I didn't even have to mumble. I was great at saying how remorseful I was, but they had heard it. They'd heard it and heard it and heard it and heard it. But what they hadn't done is they hadn't seen it. For years, they hadn't seen it. So they really didn't need to hear it again. What they needed to do was see new principles being demonstrated in my life toward them for the rest of my life, right? They needed to just see me behaving toward them differently without needing a big pat on the back or a good for you, kid, or a, you know, hey, that's great, man. Look at you, just you know, all this. No, they just needed to see me doing it. And in time, they did change. You know, first month, I think it was a, let's see. He's been well behaved for a month before. 3 months, maybe certain of the more optimistic of them were starting to think, this is pretty nice, right? But you start to get, you know, a year of good treatment, 2 years of good treatment, improved, you know, behaviors, different spiritual principles, living this spiritual life, the people around you will change their attitude toward you in time, right? But our behavior will convince them more than our words. And we've got to remember, I drank and then eventually started getting high for a period of about 21 years. And a period, you know, 10 or 20 years of drunkenness or more would make a skeptic out of just about anybody. We should treat it as a small miracle that people are willing to revise their opinions of us at all when they are. And we got to accept, as I had to accept, there are some people who aren't going to want to do that. And as to those people, then there's a very important category that the book discusses about wrongs we can never fully right. And I hear all sorts of wild ass ideas about this. For example, sometimes people are dead, right? There are people who I've wronged who died mad at me. And that's sad. What do we do about that? Do we worry about it? Do we write them a letter that we sort of burn at their gravesite? Do we do it, any number of other dramatic sounding things that I've heard? Well, we can do whatever you want. What the book says is we don't worry about them if we can honestly say to ourselves that we would write them if we could. That's a very important qualifier, right? This is, so if there's a wrong, you can't fully right. Let me give you another example, maybe a little less dramatic than death. Wronged all sorts of people that I have no idea how to get in contact with anymore. And it was years ago in a different city, and I'm unlikely to ever cross their path again. If I encountered one of them just walking down the street or sitting down in a sandwich shop, am I willing to just walk right up to them and, you know, assuming this is what the direction I get from God, you know, make things right then and there? If so, then I don't worry about the fact that, like, wow, there are some people I really horribly mistreated walking around, but I have no idea how to get a hold of them. Or another very common scenario, maybe we reach out to somebody who we've wronged and we don't hear back. They don't want to talk to us, right? Which makes it sort of impossible to really, I mean, have a discussion or anything, right? We do in that situation is don't worry about them. As long as we're sure we could write them, we would write it if we could, because that's really just self-centered. Right? Sitting around feeling bad about all the wrongs that you can't right is just more ways of kicking your own ass and thinking about yourself in a very tricky way. Instead, If there are wrongs you can't fully right, you would if you could, then think about the people you can do something for, right? If you've wronged a bunch of people who are dead and that bothers you, why not think about all the people who are alive that you can do something to improve the life of? Maybe even people you've never wronged, but you could just be helpful to. There are a lot of people walking around on this earth who might need what you can do for them a lot more than the people who are dead, right? So that's what this book says. Sometimes that, you know, there are people who can't be seen. Maybe you send them an honest letter. Maybe you send them a text message. There's a million things to do, right? And in some cases, it says, there might be a valid reason for postponement. The example that I would give is sometimes it's genuinely not clear how to make a situation right, and you don't want to approach a person until you do have some kind of idea of how to do that, but you're working on it actively, right? Or sometimes maybe you need to, like in my case that I was discussing before, maybe you need to sit down with a bankruptcy attorney and figure out how exactly you are going to get right with all your creditors, stuff like that. Fine, but don't delay if it can be avoided, right? Don't delay if it can be avoided. If you do all of that stuff, right? If you just take all that really practical advice, then the output you will get are the ninth step promises, which are described on pages 83 to 84. And you've all heard them read so many times that I'm not going to necessarily reread them. But what I would point out to you is that all that stuff, the new freedom, the new happiness, you know, self-seeking slipping away, fear of people and economic insecurity leaving us. I guess I will read some of them. All that stuff, which sounds good, and it is good. That is not the paycheck of just like being in the fellowship of CA or just like attending meetings or reading the book a lot or talking to your sponsor. Those are outputs from the process of making amends. And if you want to experience those things, then you got to do that stuff. It is scary, but it is tremendously worthwhile. I've experienced all of them. But I only experienced these things when I was willing to ask for the willingness and follow through. And if you do that, then I'm confident you'll experience the same thing and in some even better stuff down the road. So I've been talking for about half an hour, and that seems like enough to me. So thanks very much for listening to me, and I'll be curious to hear what you have to say.